from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made in January when Donald Trump told Republican donors that he would not run for governor if he had to face a primary. According to multiple sources, Trump chafed at the thought of any opposition. But Republicans had largely already agreed privately that the only way to beat Andrew Cuomo in November would be to emerge united in the spring, coalescing around a single candidate, not wasting time and dollars in an internecine struggle. Now, many of us doubted Trump would ever run anyway, but the debate was on. Would it be Trump or downstate county executive Rob Astorino? This week, we finally have our answer, it seems. We also have some clarity about the Common Core, and we witnessed an interesting spectacle involving Governor Cuomo and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio this week. A lot going on. We want to bring in our Capitol correspondent, Karen DeWitt, to help us sort some of it out. Hello, Karen.
Hey, Evan.
Well, let's start with the governor's race, because we do finally have some clarity, or at least so it would seem. For
That's
those great. Who missed the news, what's going on?
Well, Rob Astorino, the Westchester County executive, made it official. We pretty much knew that he was going to announce, but this was his official announcement. And as mentioned in the newscast, he spoke in the Bronx this morning. Interesting that he didn't pick a Westchester spot. But yesterday, he actually officially announced his campaign in the form of a video. That's becoming more popular. I think they have a lot more control over the content, and they don't have to answer questions from those pesky reporters. But Astorino painted a very grim picture of New York under Governor Cuomo. He sort of likened it to being like a prison sentence with the highest taxes in the nation, a poor economy. He said Cuomo's, you know, claims that everything's getting better is just a fairy tale. He attacked the governor on the Common Core, calling it Cuomo's Common Core. And, you know, according to Astorino, everything is just really terrible here under Cuomo, and simply must elect somebody else.
Yeah,
like him.
And Karen, to Karen's point there, let's listen, if we could, to a couple of sound cuts. They come from the video that Rob Astorino did put together. And in this video, as Karen mentioned, you will hear, a lot of our listeners might never have heard Rob Astorino's voice before. He was on this program last month, but this may be the first time you're hearing from the man who's likely to be the Republican candidate. This is a clip from the video that Rob Astorino has released this week. Let's listen.
We have the highest taxes in the country, the worst business climate, the most corrupt government, and the second highest electric rates anywhere. Since Andrew Cuomo has been governor, New York has lost more of its citizens than any other state.
Okay, so let's start with the point of corrupt government, Karen. I mean, I understand in many ways what he's talking about, but what measure is he using to say the most corrupt government anywhere?
Well, you know, I mean, that's relative, but there has been a parade of legislators who've been indicted, arrested, gone to prison, had to resign, had all kinds of criminal accusations against them. To clarify, nobody in the governor's office since Cuomo has been there has been in any kind of major scandal. So he's sort of lumping in Governor Cuomo with the state legislature.
He wants Cuomo to wear everything that has happened.
Absolutely.
Here's another cut from that same video. This is more of Rob Astorino making his pitch in his announcement video.
As a state, are we winning or are we losing today? Because if New York is winning, reelect Andrew Cuomo. But if New York is losing, and the evidence says it is, we need to make a change.
I think that's a good, you know, that's a good key slogan and simple point to make, because I think in a lot of regions upstate, you're going to say, yeah, we're losing. So I think that he does, you know, he definitely hits a chord there.
And in this case, we've heard from Unshackle Upstate, which is a sort of a pro-business organization that helps set some policy agenda ideas and guide the business climate and work with legislators. And they continue to point out the fact that New York is the worst business climate in the state, despite nearly 4 years of a Cuomo administration. Will that hurt the governor, Karen?
Well, yeah. And I mean, I think that's why the governor has spent so much time upstate over the last year, particularly in Buffalo. I don't know why he's chosen Buffalo over Rochester, but he has. I think because he lost many of the most western counties in the state to Carl Palladino last time. So he has tried to be in upstate more, giving away grants, his Regional Economic Development Council, and just trying to act like he's very interested and enthusiastic about upstate and trying to promote the industries that we do have, like, you know, yogurt and the wine industry, and trying to promote high tech. So the governor is vulnerable there. Upstate, I think, is about half the voters in an election, which is surprising because in population we're less. So he does have to worry about that. But you do have all the New York City more liberal types who are going to go with Cuomo. So certainly Astorino faces, he faces an uphill battle in terms of money, and with Governor Cuomo still pretty popular in you know in many other parts of the state and with many people even upstate. But one other point I would make about Astorino is, you know, I've met him a few times now. He definitely is charming. He's ready for prime time. He doesn't look like somebody who's going to make, you know, silly gaffes or mistakes. And so he seems like a viable candidate in that way. But I think the problem is he's not going to have a lot of money to put out ads. And we've already seen Governor Cuomo's, you know, starting to put several ads out because he has all this money.
Yeah. One of the terms I heard used, I talked to a Democratic Party operative after Rob Astorino was on our show last month. And they said that's the first time I've heard him at length. And he was polished. He was prepared. He sounds like a candidate. And now he is for governor. And the issue is going to be name recognition and really just getting traction. So, Karen, I know
just one other point that I almost forgot
sure.
to mention is one thing that he does have a vulnerability is he is pro-life, anti-abortion. He holds some conservative social views, and some of the Democrats, particularly Cuomo, may make a big deal out of that. In fact, as soon as we're done doing this segment, I'm here at the Capitol. The Senate Democrats are going to have a press conference shortly to denounce Astorino as an extremist. So that is a weakness that we should mention that he's going to face.
Now, I want to listen to a conversation, a short conversation I had with Assemblyman Bill Nojay, who's from our area up here. Now, mm-hmm. Bill Nojay has been trying for a while, among others, to bring Donald Trump into the race. And I wanted to ask him why Trump and not Astorino. And we're going to hear Bill Nojay's comments. And then, Karen, you can talk about the fact that I know you've covered a few races in your career and how uphill of a battle will Mr. Astorino have compared to predecessors in terms of simply starting with such low name recognition. So let's listen to what Bill Nojay had to say.
I think Rob Astorino would be a great candidate. I think he'd be a great governor. I've had many conversations with Rob. In fact, I spoke with him last week at some length. He gave me a call and to check in, and I said, Rob, we talked about what the campaign issues are going to be. He's come out with an 8-point platform. I think he'll run a great campaign. But Rob Astorino is somebody who is unknown to 75% of New Yorkers.
He has a lot of work to
polls,
to do.
And he does not have a whole lot of money in the bank. He's got an awful lot of work to do, and the election is 8 months away. The advantage of Donald Trump, and those of us who have been urging Trump to get into the game, do so because he's got great name ID, and he is able to self-finance a campaign. Everybody knows who Donald Trump is. I think he's right on the issues for New York State. I think he'd be a great candidate, and again, I think he'd be a great governor. Whether that means he wants to be a candidate for governor is another matter. I think he is wrestling back and forth between the demands upon his family and his business. He's got business projects going on all over the world. In fact, when I was in his office a couple of weeks ago, about 45 minutes into the discussion, there was a knock at the door, and a woman comes in and says, Mr. Trump, the prime minister is on the line. That is the level that Donald Trump is working
in. He's a master delegator, Bill.
He is a great delegator, but he's also got business interest and projects all over the planet. And he's got to decide, do I really want to drop all that to run for governor of New York and deal with the likes of Sheldon Silver and the New York City politicians, or does he want to continue doing what he's been doing for the last 40 years?
So that's Assemblyman Bill Nojay, who has been on the case of Donald Trump. Is it now, Karen, now that Rob Astorino's in, is it over for Donald Trump? What are you hearing?
Well, I don't think so yet. At least it isn't over for Donald Trump talking about running for governor. He's going to be at a dinner in Syracuse, I think, next week, if I'm not mistaken. So he hasn't said no yet. But I think Bill Nojay makes a good point. I think someone like Trump or a lot of business people, they think they can come into state government and just, you know, order people around, like in their business, and do things very efficiently. And there's just so many obstacles. You've got bureaucrats. You've got union workers with contracts. You've got the legislature that has its own power base. I mean, look at Eliot Spitzer. He thought he could come in and just order everybody around because everyone agreed that it was dysfunctional. And, you know, it didn't work out too well for him with that kind of attitude. So I think it would be be difficult. But I think another key that Mr. Noja, point that he made is about money. You really got to have money. I mean, you can talk to public radio, you can talk to the TV news, but you got to have ads. You got to have ads during sports programs, during entertainment programs. Your name just has to be out there. You know, voters need to be sort of hit over the head with that. And Astorino doesn't have the money to do that. And Cuomo does. He's got $33 million. He's already spending it on ads to promote some of his budget proposals. So that's just a major, major obstacle.
263-WXXI, 263-9994. If you want to weigh in on this or other political topics, we've got a little bit more time with Karen DeWitt, our Capitol correspondent. And, Karen, you've covered races where there's an incumbent governor and a challenger with a tall hill to climb when it comes to name recognition. How does Astorino compare, and is there enough time for him to become recognized and at least gain enough traction to make this competitive?
You know, honestly, I hate to say this, but because I really enjoy covering races and I like to see a good fight, I would have to say no at this point. Cuomo would have to make a major mistake to lose this race. Something really bad would have to happen, which doesn't seem like it's going to. I mean, they are relatively clean in terms of you know, ethics and problems like that. I mean, something would drastically have to change, I think, at this point. And I think Astorino kind of knows that. I mean, he's not going to totally admit it now that he's in, but I think he said something more to the effect, you know, I ran in Westchester because it was the right thing to do, not necessarily to win, and I think maybe that could apply to this race as well.
But Mr. Astorino, and I've heard other Republicans tell me that Common Core, they're going to try to make Cuomo wear it. It's pretty unpopular, and the SAFE Act has galvanized conservative Republicans, especially upstate, to the point where they think that maybe they can get the momentum and raise enough money to give it a shot.
Well, I don't know about that, but Cuomo has certainly lost those people. He really didn't know how much he was going to alienate people who are Second Amendment rights advocates. So I don't think he's getting those people back. But there's all the New York City voters, though. And where are they going to go? They're not going to go to the right. So he has them. And really, I think a lot of the battle's going to be in the New York City suburbs, Westchester and Long Island. And the governor's got this, you know, whole tax freeze proposal that, if it works out, is going to mean big rebate checks in the mail for all these New York City suburban voters just a couple of weeks before Election Day. So that can help them out, and he's doing a lot of things that people in the suburbs like, because that's really where the, you know, might be a swing vote if there is one.
Speaking of New York City, there was a fascinating little exchange of rallies, and we're going to get to that in 1 second, but I do want to grab a quick caller here. Bob in Brighton is on the line with Karen DeWitt on this Thursday afternoon. Thanks for calling, Bob.
No problem. Thanks for taking the call and joining the program. I just find it fascinating that so much of the talk about the governorship, the races, are just that. It's a horse race thing. But I also found it fascinating that Bill Noje would, I know Bill, would take Donald Trump seriously as right for New York, and how Trump would be no different, really, than Carl Palladino. Greater name recognition, but easily seen as being more about Donald Trump than about New York State and policies. Yeah. That was just my comment.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. I appreciate that. Karen, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I think it speaks to the dearth of GOP up-and-coming stars in this state. I mean, the biggest faction is the Republican senators, and most of them are older. They're not going to run for governor. They're sort of going to probably finish their career in the Senate. There aren't that many people to choose from. It's, you know, even 2 decades ago, we had Rudy Giuliani, we had George Pataki, who won, although that's true, he came out of nowhere, but that was Mario Cuomo, who was trying to run for his fourth term. So that was a little different dynamic there. But you don't have a lot of big-name Republicans in New York State who would be the kind that people know and would be poised to run for governor. So you either have a little-known county executive who's ambitious and or you have, you know, a big-name business person.
We mentioned the SAFE Act, and Gary from Greece wants to weigh in on that. Go ahead, Gary.
Hi, thanks for coming on today.
Sure.
And this SAFE Act keeps coming up,
and how it's hurt the governor. But when I'm wondering, and it's, maybe you can clarify this too, but when the polls come in, and it's almost like Obamacare, you know, they're against the SAFE Act, but when you ask people things like, well, do you think there should be a background check for an assault, the purchase of an assault rifle, the vast majority of people are in favor of that. When women are separated from men, most of the polls, Quinnipiac being one of them, show that over 90% of women, who are half the voters, favor the SAFE Act, and that close to half the men do. So I'm wondering what's your opinion. Is it just that a lot of money has been spent by the NRA in scope to make us believe that this is a big issue? Or do you think it really is?
I think it really is. I have sort of the benefit of actually living out in a rural area and knowing that there's a lot of people who are mad about this. It just touched a chord in a weird way. And I think that there's, and it's true, it is a minority people, but they have been very, very vocal about it. Certainly the NRA, you know, plays into that. But it does seem like, you know, just a genuine dislike, like, why is this person telling us what to do? We're not criminals. We safely used our guns, and, you know, we don't want to be, you know, lumped in with people who are criminals or who go out and do massive shootings. And I obviously, Governor Cuomo did not expect that, or he wouldn't have done that, because he's a very careful and calculating politician.
Can I ask the follow-up then?
Yes.
And I agree 100% with what you're saying, and it's a very vocal group. But that still doesn't make them the majority of voters.
No,
I think I would ask this in regards to the, you know, Cuomo passing it. I mean, we know it's a myth that the assembly passes in the middle of the night. That's not even true. But the Senate passed it. It was after a full debate in the assembly,
yes,
in a daytime debate. So, but my question is under the circumstances with the power that scope and the NRA has, could this be interpreted as good leadership? Because if we had waited, we'd still have nothing rather than being a leader in this country.
Well, that's true.
Thanks, Gary.
If he wins re-election and then, you know, just has to accept that there's certain people who are just not going to like him in this state, then, yeah, it could be seen that way, absolutely.
And Karen, and we got to get to this de Blasio Cuomo thing in a second, but let me just kind of weigh in as well on what Gary's saying. The conservative voters in rural areas I speak to upstate tell me that they're probably not Cuomo voters to begin with, but they are much more mobilized to get to the polls now and bring others to the polls. That, yes, the opposition to the SAFE Act is probably a minority, but it's one of those really motivated minorities. That will make it a little easier for a Republican candidate to get a larger margin upstate, which they're going to need a big margin upstate to make it close. But I think Gary also makes a very fair point that when you ask people about specifics of either the Affordable Care Act or the SAFE Act, a lot of people will agree, maybe not with every line, but with a lot of the provisions. Mm-hmm. So I do think there's some complexity to the issue. I do think the anger is real on the right, and I think it will be interesting to see what happens in November. Fair conclusion?
Absolutely.
Okay, so we'll be watching that one. Okay, Karen, set up what happened with these dueling rallies with the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, and Governor Cuomo.
Well, for several weeks we were anticipating on March 4th that Mayor Bill de Blasio was going to come up from New York City, that he was going to speak at this big rally for universal pre-K, supporting his plan to tax the wealthy in New York City to pay for it. About 1,500 people were expected, pretty, you know, healthy-sized rally for Albany. And then a few days before that, this charter school rally was organized, mostly from charter school operators who are mad at Bill de Blasio because he wants to kick them out of some free space they have in public schools. Governor Cuomo, I started hearing rumors about this the night before, was going to speak at this larger charter school rally. So you have Bill de Blasio's rally going on about two blocks away from the Capitol, and then this big charter school rally where they took all the kids out of school. There was maybe about 5,000 people, and Cuomo showed up at the anti-Bill de Blasio rally and was all fired up to speak to these kids and these teachers. And this is a governor who really seldom speaks to any groups. We have, you know, dozens of groups that come to Albany and rallies, and he's almost never at them. So it was an unusual thing for him to do.
We have a couple of quick clips from each of them, if we could listen to them. The first is from Mayor Bill de Blasio. It's a little echoey because this is a shot from the crowd. The Times Union published these clips, but I think you can get a gist of the energy and what the mayor of New York City is saying here. Let's listen.
And because of your work, because of your energy, because of your passion, we are closer than ever to opening next school year with 54,000 full-day pre-K seats in New York City.
So there's Mayor de Blasio, and as Karen said, here's the duel with Governor Cuomo outside with his rally. Let's listen.
They say it's cold out here, but I don't feel cold. I feel hot. I feel fired up. We are going to save charter schools, and you're making it happen.
That's Governor Cuomo talking about saving charter schools. Karen, I'm trying to understand the optics here because Mayor de Blasio has risen in stature rather quickly since his election. And the question is this wise for Governor Cuomo to sort of be tangling a bit with a mayor he'll probably need as an ally?
Yeah, but the thing is, Cuomo and the legislature, they hold a lot of power over the New York City mayor. Bill de Blasio cannot raise taxes on the rich in New York City unless the governor and legislature give him permission. The governor doesn't want to. Republicans in the Senate don't want to. But Cuomo's taking it a step further because it seems that every opportunity he wants to one-up this guy.
I know.
And his aides, you know, were making this special point going around of, like, how many more people were at Cuomo's rally. At one point, they said there were 11,000 people. Well, there weren't 11,000 people, but there was, you know, substantially more. And they just make such a kind of a tit-for-tat big deal over, you know, everything that the governor does compared to the New York City mayor. Interestingly enough, they had the governor and the mayor had this two-hour closed-door meeting. And it would be interesting to then at that meeting where de Blasio met with Cuomo, he came out and, you know, said the usual, it was productive.
Yes, yes, yes.
Didn't give any details, but it'd be interesting to be a fly on the wall in that meeting and see how it went, because it seems, and at least from what I'm hearing from, you know, some sources, that, you know, Bill de Blasio, I mean, he knows he's being dissed right and left, but he's holding his temper publicly for now.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how long can he do that. And even though he's probably going to lose on his tax the rich measure, he is just not backing down. He seems to think it's better to just go to the bitter end instead of making a compromise at this point.
Was the governor's charter school rally designed to let Mr. de Blasio know his place, so to speak, that he's, you know, to kind of take a step back and know who's in charge?
Yeah, that is absolutely how it was conveyed. I also wonder how this pre-K rally ended up not on the grounds of the state capitol. I didn't realize that till a day before. They were in an armory building a couple blocks up the street, leaving the whole capitol steps free for something else to happen. So they were, I think they were even outmaneuvered in, you know, the placement of where the rally was.
All right, last quick subject, because I'm taking way too much of your time on this busy Thursday afternoon. Karen DeWitt, our Capitol correspondent. The Assembly is touting, and Joe Morelli's office touting their movement on Common Core, and there does seem to be a coalescing around this issue. Give us the latest on Common Core.
It would delay the effects of these tests for two more years on both the students and the teachers, because the teachers were supposed to be evaluated on the results of these tests, and everybody agrees it's pretty much been disastrously rolled out. What's interesting is this is a slap to the State Board of Regents. Assembly Democrats essentially pick the State Board of Regents because it requires a vote of every single member of the legislature, and they have the largest faction. So at first, Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver kept saying, well, we'll wait to see what the regents do, and the regents kind of choked. They didn't want to delay the effects for the teachers, though they did for the students. And so the Assembly had to move in, and I think we're going to see a similar bill in the Senate. And I think they will come to some agreement on a moratorium before the next month. Governor Cuomo has his own panel, by the way, and he'll probably make some recommendations. But, yeah, they really had to, because they had to respond to public outcry. People, parents, teachers, kids are really, really upset over this. It was a very bad fall, very bad rollout on this whole thing. And they got to do something. They're all facing re-election this year, and they got to get this settled.
Sure, but finally, Governor Cuomo has said the basic concept of Common Core, even if it's been executed, is poor. he does think there's great value there, and it does seem from the White House on down, from a lot of executives around the country, that Common Core is going to survive in some form going forward, don't you know?
Yeah, it's too late to go back. And as the Assembly Democrats pointed out, because the minority party Republicans had an amendment, so let's just scrap this Common Core. It's a mess. They said the state's already gotten over $1 billion to implement it, and the schools have spent it. So you can't go back at this point. You have to cope with making it work somehow, and perhaps it will, but it seems like it needs a few more years for everybody to know exactly what they're supposed to be teaching and what students are supposed to be learning.
All right, a lot going on at the Capitol. Remind us what you're going off to next, Karen.
Well, I'm hoping to see the Senate Democrats, as soon as the session is over, denouncing Rob Astorino as an extremist. So, you know. Political season has begun.
It has begun, but we're going to – we will, as the caller mentioned, yes, there are horse races, but we will also cover the substance as we always do. And Karen DeWitt, it's always great to catch up with you. Thanks for the time.
Thank you. It was fun.
Karen DeWitt from Albany, our Capitol correspondent, one of the best. And it's always nice to check in and find out what's happening and get perspective. It's part of what our commitment is to you as listeners here on WXXI, and we'll continue to do that for you. Here's what we're going to do now. We're going to take a short break, and when we come right back, we're going to take a look at what's becoming a rather serious situation in the Finger Lakes region. Another really viciously cold morning. We know that now it's beautiful and sunny, and the temperatures are going to feel normal by mid-afternoon. But this morning, we had negative readings once again, and there could be a real cumulative effect here for Finger Lakes grape growers and the region, and we're going to get into the actual specifics and details with the man who's best positioned to do that. He's on with us next. You're listening to Connections on member-supported public radio.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Cheshire, providing audio and video technologies for meetings, events, and trade shows, including content creation. CheshireAV.com.
Welcome back. It's a beautiful Thursday afternoon, but don't be fooled. We had, once again this morning, some of the lowest temperatures of the season, and one of the things I heard was maybe the lowest temperatures in Rochester on a day in March ever today. So very, very rough morning, and that could be a very serious situation for growers. We've got Hans Walter Peterson on with us now. Hans is the Viticulture Extension Specialist for Cornell Cooperative Extension's Finger Lakes Grape Program, and Hans right now is, I think you're down at Glenora on Seneca Lake. Is that where you are, Hans?
I'm sitting up near Glenora Winery having a lovely view of an open but cold Seneca Lake.
Yes, it is. I know it's a beautiful day, but Hans, you have been traveling throughout the region this morning, and we're going to talk about the possible effects that we've been seeing from this cold weather. First, why don't we take a quick step back and let our listeners know what it is that you do with the Grapes Program.
Yeah, so I work for Cornell's Extension System, and so basically what that means is that I work with growers throughout the Finger Lakes, keeping them updated on research and kind of cutting-edge information that we think can help them to grow their grapes better, whether it's producing better quality fruit or more of it, or reducing their costs, reducing the amount of sprays that they need to put on, things like that. So we really try to keep up to date on research that's being done both at Cornell and by colleagues of ours around the country to help grape growers do their job better.
And now we're looking at what some are describing as the worst winter in more than a decade, or roughly a decade. And, you know, the winter's not over yet, but how would we characterize it so far?
Well, I think you hit it on the head, Evan. It's probably the harshest one we've had since 2004. But certainly a bit different from that. 2004 was the last winter where we really experienced some pretty significant damage to the grapevines in the Finger Lakes. And that year we had just one or maybe two nights that got very cold for a relatively short amount of time, a couple of hours, but it got cold enough that it really caused some damage to vines. This year, obviously, has been a different story. We maybe didn't get quite to the absolute temperatures that we did back then, but we've had more episodes where we've been below zero than we've had in a long time. And as we have more of those, you know, episodes at minus 9, minus 10, minus 12, minus 14 in some spots, there's a certain point where certain grape varieties just can't survive those kinds of temperatures. So that's what we're looking at right now is a fair bit of bud death in a number of vineyards. It all depends on location and variety and whatnot, but like I said, it's been the worst since 2004.
We're talking to Hans Walter Peterson, a viticulture extension specialist for Cornell Cooperative Extension's Finger Lakes Grape Program, and this is a great opportunity for you to jump in with a question or a comment if you have them about really the science of grape growing and what happens in a winter like this one. 263-WXXI, 263-9994. I'm also on Twitter. You can follow me and jump in the conversation there, as a lot of people are doing, at Evan Dawson on Twitter. Hans, you touched on, I think, let's make an important distinction. There's two very different things when it comes to winter damage. There's vine death and there's bud damage. Let's talk about the difference if we could.
Sure. Yeah, it's basically when you look at a vine, you know, you have the trunk, which is the permanent structure, you know, just like a tree or something like that. And then you have the buds, which are the organs that contain this coming year's shoots and leaves and clusters, grape clusters. So those buds can survive cold temperatures down to a certain point, and after that point, the tissues start to freeze and die. When that happens, the vine still has survival mechanisms that it can use to still produce leaves, but it doesn't produce a crop, or not as much of a crop. So if the buds die on a vine, the vine can still survive if there's no damage to the rest of the vine. If it's just those buds, a grower doesn't get any fruit from that. So basically it's a one-year crop loss, which isn't fun by any means, of course. But, you know, the vine can survive that. The thing that we get really concerned about when we get cold episodes like this is damage to the trunk. And if you think about a trunk as kind of a big collection almost of straws, in a way. What happens when we get vine injury or trunk injury is that some of those straws basically don't work anymore. And so the vine needs all those straws to be functioning in order to get water and nutrients up from the soil into the clusters, into the leaves. And if not all those straws are working, then at some point the vine could collapse and die. And if that happens, you either have to hope that there's a new shoot that you can create a new trunk from, and if that doesn't happen, you have to replant the vine. And so in either one of those cases, you're looking at multiple years without a crop in that vineyard from that vine. So that's the big difference that we're looking at, is that if it's just bud injury, it's a one-year impact. And then 2015, we can be back to almost normal production. If a vineyard has a lot of trunk injury, then you're talking a more sustained, longer-term loss.
And again, how much trunk injury have we at least recorded so far, if any?
We really don't know. It's the buds we can test relatively easily. You basically take them in and cut them open with a razor blade after a little bit of time indoors, and you can see if they're green or they're not green. With trunks, it's a much harder deal to test before the season starts, and basically we won't know the answer to that question until the growing season starts. So probably in late May and June, we'll start to get an idea of how much trunk injury there is out there.
Is there a suspicion that there will be some because of the temperatures we've seen?
Yeah, the trunk tissues are a little bit more hardy than the buds, but not a whole lot. We know from past experience with winter injury, both here and in other parts of the country, that when we start seeing bud injury over 50%, or maybe a little bit more, then it seems there's an increased risk that we're going to have some trunk injury. And so we've got vineyards, some varieties, some spots that are well over 50% bud damage in some of their varieties. And so we're expecting that there will be at least some trunk damage in those vineyards.
But that doesn't mean, and this is an important distinction now, I heard a conversation last night where there was a question about whether that means the wine won't be any good this year. And my response was, it has nothing to do with how good the 2014 wines could be. It's a matter of volume. Fair point. How would you characterize no one knows what 2014 vintage will be like, but this doesn't preclude it from being a good one.
Absolutely not. It's a question of volume. It's not going to be a question of quality by any means. From the volume standpoint, not every vineyard and not every winery is impacted the same way. There are certain varieties that are having more of a struggle this year than others. Those varieties are going to be in a little bit shorter supply. For wines that are made from varieties like Concord and Catawba, and some of those varieties, they're much more winter hardy, and we've seen very little damage beyond what we normally see in a regular winter in those varieties and some of the hybrid varieties. And even with the vinifera varieties, which are the ones that most people know the names of, so Riesling here in the Finger Lakes is one of the big ones for us, and Pinot Noir and Chardonnay and those are more sensitive to cold damage like we would have this year. But there are certain vineyards that are having less injury than others. So there might be some vineyards that have some crop loss, but it's not too bad. But others are going to be more so. So it's we really don't know the impact of how big of a deal this is going to be. But it is, like you're saying, more a question of volume than quality for sure.
Yvette on Twitter says, I love my Finger Lakes Riesling. Tell me there will be Riesling. Again, to the point you just made, some more hardy than others, but too early.
Yeah, we won't know the full extent of what's going to happen with the crop until this summer. We see how trunks do and how the vines come through. Among those varieties that are more sensitive to cold, Riesling is one of the better ones. A lot of people will know that Riesling, one of its home bases besides the Finger Lakes these days, is Germany, which has winters that are fairly similar to ours, can get a little bit chilly. So it's well adapted for those kind of conditions. So Riesling is doing better than some other varieties. So there will be Riesling here in 2014, probably just not as much as we're used to.
We're talking to Hans Walter Peterson, a viticulture extension specialist from Cornell Cooperative Extension's Finger Lakes Grape Program, and he has been monitoring what certainly looks like the worst winter in the region in a decade. And it was just a couple of weeks ago that WXXI reported on the visit of Senator Chuck Schumer. He was here, and Hans, I know you were with him. What did you talk to the senator about, and how did that go?
It was great for the senator to come and to be here and talk to the growers a little bit. What the senator was mainly pointing out during his visit was some of the provisions that are in the farm bill, the new farm bill that just recently passed, that could help growers deal with some of the damage or some of the costs of dealing with this damage. One of the programs that he talked about specifically is a program called the Tree Assistance Program, which despite its name also applies to grapevines. And that's basically a program that's been in the Farm Bill and with USDA for a number of years, but it expired before this new Farm Bill was in place. And basically that program, the CAP program, helps to defray some of the costs of removing vineyards that have been killed because of something like winter injury and replanting. So it doesn't take care of all of it by any means. There's certain thresholds and things that growers have to meet. But it is some funding that is available from the government to help if some vineyards have to replant some of those vines. The other thing that he was mentioning quickly is just possibility of USDA declaring kind of a crop disaster in certain parts of the Finger Lakes, which would make growers eligible for low interest loans from USDA. So again, that's something that we won't know until we get into the season and really have a sense of just how much damage there is.
Tom on Facebook wants to know if Hans can talk about whether it truly is warmer around the lakes and if the vines would be protected because of that.
Yeah, so that's if you look at a map of New York and you look at where all the grape growing happens in the state of New York, you'll notice one common thing, and that's water. Whether it's the Atlantic Ocean and the Sound and Long Island or Lake Ontario up by Niagara County and Wayne County where there's some vineyards or Lake Erie or the Finger Lakes. So the lakes do offer us some protection. And it all depends on the year. If you look at Cuca Lake right now, our lovely, the Crooked Lake, as we like to call it, it's completely covered with ice. So we don't get any protection from that lake right now, which is kind of unfortunate. But Seneca Lake and Cayuga Lake are still open because of their depth. And because those that open water is warmer than the air in most of the winter, that warmer air can come up onto the shoreline and warm some of these areas that are close to the lake. So one of the things that we haven't seen in our initial surveys, but we're going to take a closer look at in this next injury survey we're doing in a couple of weeks here, is to see just how much of a difference being close to a lake or farther away from the lake, how much of a difference there is in the amount of injury within a variety. So if there's a Riesling vineyard that's within a quarter mile of the lake and a Riesling vineyard that's a mile and a half away from the lake, how much difference in injury is there? We don't quite know yet, but in most years that is very true.
Mary on Twitter says, my uncle is an apple grower, and they always run smudge pots when it gets cold. Can't they do that in the vineyards? You want to explain what she means by that for our listeners who don't know, Hans, and then talk about maybe some techniques to fight the cold?
Right. So a smudge pot is something that's been used like the person there said, in apple orchards for a long time, and certainly in vineyards as well, older vineyards. Basically, I like to call it just kind of a glorified burn barrel, where you just have a fuel source in it, and if growers would light those at night. They can certainly help. The problem is you need a lot of them to cover a certain area, and they're really dirty, and for the most part. And so they're really not used anymore. Some growers, when we get into the spring and are trying to get 1 or even maybe 2 degrees of warmth just to prevent frost damage, we still have growers who will burn hay bales, old hay bales in their vineyard just to try to keep the temperature up. When we're dealing with the temperatures like we're having in the wintertime, this year it's a very expensive proposition to keep those fueled. And again, it's not the cleanest technology either. So there are some things that growers install, like if you go over to the over onto Niagara-on-the-Lake over in Ontario, there are a number of vineyards that have basically what look like windmills. They're wind machines that try to mix the air. When you have a very cold situation with calm nights, you can get warm air settling in over top of cold air, and if you can mix those two together, you can increase the temperature a little bit. Most of our vineyards are on slopes, though, so that air kind of mixes by itself. Those wind machines are most effective in flat spots. So unfortunately, there's not a whole lot that our growers can do, especially that can make sense economically. So we just got to hope that the lakes do their job for the most part. And this year, there's just been a little more than the lakes could help us with.
A couple more minutes with Hans Walter Peterson, a viticulture extension specialist who's monitoring damage in the Finger Lakes. A rough, rough winter. And almost certainly, it's going to result in many millions of dollars in losses for Finger Lakes wineries, because they could lose, you know, when you talk about losing up to half of your crop because of winter damage, that is potentially what we're facing, though. As Hans has been explaining, we're going to learn more in the coming weeks, especially when things warm up and we get a better look at the health of the vines. Hans, you mentioned that Cuca Lake is frozen across, and are you talking? I don't mean to get geeky here or really specific, but I have heard that the widest part of Cuca Lake is right where the Y splits at the bluff, and it's only once in every 11 years that it freezes all the way across.
That sounds about right. I think that's basically what I've heard. I think it's if I remember the maps that I've seen, the deepest part of the lake is further to the south, mm-hmm. and that part also is kind of freezes the. It's less common for that part to freeze. The eastern fork, the Y that Pinyan sits on the top of, freezes at least partially most years because it's fairly shallow. But it's fairly uncommon, relatively uncommon for the entire all of Cuca Lake to freeze over. I've been here in the Finger Lakes 7 years, and I'm pretty sure this is the first time I've seen the whole thing frozen over.
Give me a sense for the specific temperatures you look for, or if you do, Hans, because you mentioned that whether it's trying to ward off frost in the spring or dealing with the temperatures on a morning like this, where, again, if you're just joining us here on Connections on this Thursday afternoon, this morning they were in the negative digits again, and Hans and many people were out just trying to get a sense for just how cold and how serious. Is there an absolute value, or is there a number that you look for that is the warning sign, whether it's negative 7, 8, 10 degrees? What do you look for?
Yeah, if we see something approaching negative 10, we start worrying about some of the more tender varieties. So something like Merlot or Gewürztraminer, those are two kind of the highlight ones. Sauvignon Blanc seems to be one of those too. When we get near that minus 8, minus 9 number, we start to think, oh, there's a chance that there's going to be more than just a couple of buds here and there dying. A lot of times, a lot of times what happens in the winter is that we'll have just a very quick period right before sunup, before sunrise, where the clouds kind of open up and clear skies, and we get a very quick drop to minus 9 or minus 10. And then as soon as the sun comes out, the temperatures start to warm up again. That tends not to cause too much damage. If we have that minus 8, minus 9, minus 10 for a few hours, which is what we've had this year in a couple of instances, that's when we really start to get concerned about those more tender varieties. Again, if we're looking at something like Concord or Catawba, I generally don't get too worried, even if things get to minus 15, minus 16.
Let me wrap up with this question for you, Hans. For anybody who thinks of the romanticism that is involved with a vocation in grape growing, and I understand it, and you hear it all the time. Oh, you know, I want to retire and do a vineyard. What's the lesson in winters like this one, and how much appreciation do you have for the work that goes into it, knowing so much is out of your control?
If you cannot learn to accept that Mother Nature is ultimately in control, then you shouldn't be in farming, because that's what grape growing is. It is farming. So, there will be, and growers in the Finger Lakes know there will be years like this. It's not fun. Nobody likes it. Everybody's trying to figure out how they're going to make it through a year with a lower crop and therefore lower revenue, whether it's an independent grower or a winery. The wineries are starting to already talk to growers earlier than they might normally about trying to lock in purchases for the year. This is a lot of hard work, and this is part of the reality of growing grapes in the Northeast, is that this kind of thing can happen once in a while. So it's been amazing to me to see how well the growers are kind of just rolling with the punches this year, because this could be a pretty bad situation for some of them.
And by the way, Hans, when I talked to you this morning, it said negative 7 in my car. Give me in 30 seconds any of the quick temperature numbers you did see so far today.
Yeah, the weather stations that I checked down here were generally about zero to a couple of degrees above zero.
Which is a good situation. That's good news.
Yeah, it is. That's good news for us. We can handle that. It's when, like we were saying, when it gets close to double digits that we start to worry. So I think we dodged this one. Knock on wood.
Well, we will continue to do so, because unfortunately winter's not over. The next 7 to 10 days look pretty good. Hey, thank you for the time today, Hans, and we'll touch back with you as we get towards the spring and learn more about what's happening down there.
That sounds good, Evan. My pleasure.
That's Hans Walter Peterson, a viticulture extension specialist for Cornell Cooperative Extension's Finger Lakes Grape Program. He has a very difficult but important job in making sure, well, at least just kind of monitoring and understanding what's happening in the vineyards in what has been a very difficult winter. Every time you think to yourself how cold it has been this winter, think of our friends who are growers and in the Finger Lakes and elsewhere and what they have to deal with, especially in an industry like growing grapes. Very, very tough, and it could be millions of dollars of damage. All right, short break now, and we are coming back with a very different second hour. What if all of Rochester read the same book? Writers and books asked that question, and then they came up with an answer, as they always do, in 2014. We'll tell you what that book is, and we're going to hear from the author live from Alaska next.